Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled The Poetry of Suffering and Waiting. Our speaker is Bucknell University Professor of English, Harold Schweitzer. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director, Alan Spate.
Professor Schweitzer has written sensitively and searchingly about the nature of suffering, and especially about how it relates to attempts to express it in literature and the arts. He's published widely in literary theory and the medical humanities. He's the author of Suffering and the Remedy of Art, published in 1997, a book that the students in the seminar have been reading already this semester, and On Waiting, published in 2008. He was previously honored as both the NEH Chair in the Humanities and the John P. Crozer Chair of English Literature at Bucknell, and is the recipient of two teaching awards there. I should add, as I mentioned, that he is not just a critic of writing, of literary writing, but he is also a poet, and the volume of poetry is entitled The Book of Stones and Angels. It will be forthcoming from Tupelo Press soon. So a literary critic and a poet tonight, his title, the title of his lecture, is The Poetry of Waiting and Suffering. We're delighted, Professor Harold Schweitzer, to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Alan, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great honor to be here, and it's really great fun for me to be here. I'm going to read you meditations on the poetry of suffering and waiting. Okay. Waiting in a sufferer's time. In his philosophical reflections on Simone Weil's writings on suffering, Maurice Blanchot explains, affliction has a relation to time. Through affliction we endure pure time, time without event, without project, and without possibility, a kind of empty perpetuity that must be born infinitely and at every instant. Let it be over, but it is without end. Deprived of ourselves, deprived of the eye upon which we naturally lean, deprived of the world that in normal times exists in our place and disburdens us of ourselves, we are time indefinitely endured. Attention is this same relation to time. Attention is waiting. It waits without precipitation, leaving empty what is empty, and keeping our haste, our impatient desire, even more our horror of emptiness, from prematurely filling it. Attention is the emptiness of thought, oriented by a gentle force and maintained in accord with the empty intimacy of time. How interminable to share with the sufferer her existence deprived of the world. Let it be over, but it is without end. For what is so unbearable in the sufferer's burden of existence, as Blanchot describes it, is that she is time indefinitely endured. In order to be with the sufferer, we must enter her time. Let go of the world of haste, of impatient desire, of the horror of emptiness, that awkward silence. We must descend with the sufferer into nothing but her empty intimacy of time. It is only watching, waiting, attention, as Simone Weil puts it. The sufferer suffers too much. She cannot disburden herself of herself through making a thing or moving her body. The gaudy distractions of the world that in normal times exist in her place are unobtainable. She has become time's vehicle. The being of the one who suffers is experienced as time, as Adi Ophir explains in his book, The Order of Evils. Quote, every moment of the present carries with it the entire duration of suffering. End of quote. All the sufferer does is wait. She waits in the very depth of time. She cannot rise with or from her body, to move through time and make it her instrument. She waits in the unobjectified, unmapped, devouring dimensions of duration. She lives solely in her suffering. Suffering, as Emmanuel Levinas puts it, quote, is a pure undergoing. Suffering, Ophir writes, gives the suffering subject her identity, her being for the others. I endure, she complains. I endure my body. I endure my thoughts. She endures pure time, time without event, without project, and without possibility. She lies in her bed in a small room. The window is open. How can Blanchot's paragraph, deeply informed as it is by Weil's Christian ethic, inform our own relation to the sufferer? How do we, who do not have the passion of Weil's faith, find the emptiness of thought necessary for attention? How do we, who live in unprecedented haste, find that gentle force that would keep us from haste? Since Weil asks similar questions in the context of an essay entitled Reflections on the Right Use of School Studies with a View to the Love of God, I would like to ask here whether school studies, such as the study of poetry, for example, can educate us in becoming waiters of the sort Weil and Blanchot have in mind. Can poetry instruct us to imagine another suffering? Can poetry elicit from us that empathic question, what are you going through? A question that is central to Weil's understanding of our ethical and ontological relation to the sufferer. It is a recognition, Weil goes on, and I quote her, that the sufferer exists. Not only the question, that is, right? The question, what are you going through, is a recognition that the sufferer exists not only as a unit in a collection or a specimen from the social category labeled unfortunate, but as a person exactly like us, who was one day stamped with a special mark for affliction. End of quote. I endeavor here not to decipher such marks of affliction, for they are unreadable, but to recognize them, to acknowledge them, to understand how they compose a poem's intimacy. If the question, what are you going through, can be applied to a literary text, the question requires above all our empathic waiting, and there is no foreseeable end to such waiting. Nor, if one came to an end of it, the waiting, as one knows from posing this question to a sufferer, is there one clear answer, nor can one ever completely understand it. You can't imagine it, cries David Shapiro, suffering from a terminal brain tumor in a poem by his brother Alan Shapiro. You can't know what it is. You can't imagine it at all. Attention to a sufferer, to recall Blanchot's comment, necessitates an emptiness of thought oriented by a gentle force and maintained in accord with the empty intimacy of time. Even if such emptiness can only partially be achieved, it implies that our waiting, shared with the sufferer, is in itself highly valuable. And as Levinas points out, it is the only meaning of which suffering is capable. Two, the poet as a waiter. You ought to wait and gather sense and sweetness for a whole lifetime, Rainer Maria Rilke writes in the Notebooks of Malte Lauritz Bricke. For poems, he goes on, are not, as people think, simply emotions. One has emotions early enough, he says. They are experiences. Among the experiences that the writing of poetry requires, Rilke's protagonist declares are the following. It's your second quote. It's a beautiful passage, lovely passage. For the sake of a single poem, you must see many cities, many people and things. You must understand animals, must feel how birds fly and know the gesture which small flowers make when they open in the morning. You must be able to think back to streets in unknown neighborhoods, to unexpected encounters and to partings, to childhood illnesses, to many nights of love. But you must also have been beside the dying, must have sat beside the dead in the room with the open window and the panting noises. And it is not enough to have memories. You must be able to forget them when there are many. And you must have the immense patience to wait until they return. Rilke's litany of musts implies that poems are written with the kind of attention Blanchot describes above. The poet, too, must wait without precipitation, leaving empty what is empty and keeping her haste, her impatient desire, and even more, her horror of the blank page from prematurely filling it. For poems are to be written out of necessity. They are informed by events whose significance is not immediately obvious. And among those events, surely, one of the most important is the experience of having been beside the dying and having sat beside the dead. But rather than suggesting that such urgent obligations somehow eclipse the gesture of small flowers, Rilke's poetic work as a whole insists that knowing the gesture of flowers, understanding animals, and feeling how birds fly, among many other experiences, will inform who we are in the face of extreme suffering. For, as Rilke insists, third quote, only when they have changed into our very blood, into gaze and gesture, and are nameless, no longer to be distinguished from ourselves, only then can it happen that in some very rare hour, the first word of a poem arises in their midst and goes forth from them. We are shaped by experiences. We become them. They enter our very blood. They can no longer be distinguished from ourselves and have determined the singular, intimate traits of our gaze and gesture, Blick und Gebärde. When we are with the dying, when we are with the dying, our very being is made by that experience. When we sit with the dead, we begin to earn the qualities that make a poet. Thus, Rilke begins one of his sonnets to Orpheus, and it's very simple. You don't have it before you. Only he, it's a beautiful poem, I need the water. Only he who has also raised his lyre among shadows may find his way back to infinite praise. Only he who has eaten with the dead from their stores of poppy will never lose again the softest chord. The veritably holy seriousness to which Rilke appoints the poet requires empathy, openness, and immense patience. It requires, in other words, no less than one's being, one's presence. It requires the courage of the question, what are you going through? And the courage to listen, to hear an answer, to bear it, and to respond with empathy, such as Rilke implies in many of his poems, most famously perhaps in that one poem that you might know, one of the poems that you might know, The Panther. Rilke's poet is the exemplary waiter, from whom we might learn what it means to wait with attention. It is thus of no small importance that in his novel he mentions the room, the open window, and the panting noises during the vigil with the dying and the dead, for these ordinary and simple details convey intimacy, endurance, waiting, a particular time and place, a lived, shared history. But the return of such memories must itself be waited for. It cannot be rushed or forced, to which Rilke's decade-long waiting for the Duino elegies testifies. And when the memories return, they return, as Rilke says, namenlos, nameless. In the ninth of the Duino elegies, he calls, quote, the sufferings, the heaviness, and the long experience of love, wholly unsayable, end of quote. For the task of the poet is not to assume that the opening of small flowers, the flight of birds, or dying can be named or mastered. The poet is precisely to convey the namelessness of such experiences and thus the urgency of their expression, their intimate, secret subjectivity, and their unrepeatable singularity, such as shape our being all the way down to blood, gaze, and gesture, those Kristeven semiotic aspects of ourselves of which we are wholly unaware. The very namelessness of flowers opening and birds flying may in turn beget little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love, as Wordsworth, very similarly to Rilke, writes in Tintern Abbey. It seems to me not an accident that Rilke chooses a somewhat odd word gesture, Geberde, that flowers make when they open in the morning, and then repeats the same word to apply to humans, suggesting perhaps an affinity between flowers and humans, as if the gestures of flowers were to inform us of our comparable vulnerability. As if, to use Adam Jagosawski's phrase, we might learn from flowers what, quote, what they want to say, since they speak our language of gesture. Levinas invokes the human face that calls us to be who we are precisely in the way Rilke invokes the gesture of flowers as, quote, Levinas, nakedness, extreme exposure, defenselessness, vulnerability itself. That's the face. So intimate are our bodily gestures, so fragile the gestures of flowers, so naked the human face, so nameless our acts of kindness and of love, that they necessitate a poetic, lyrical discourse. They cannot be rendered through conventional language. Deprived of ourselves, deprived of the eye upon which we naturally lean, how do we write or read the gestures of flowers, of faces of kindness and of love? Analogously, if the sufferer exists not only as a unit in a collection or a specimen from the social category labeled unfortunate, how do we know her without recourse to collections and categories? Rilke's answer might be, as we know flowers, animals, birds flying, as we know beauteous forms, Wordsworth might say, as we know faces, Levinas might say, quote, this intimacy can only be discreetly, Levinas remarks in a similar context. And I go on, it cannot give itself out as an example or be narrated in an edifying discourse. It cannot, without becoming perverted, be made into a preachment. The it being the language of suffering. Suffering, as Ophir puts it, may demand a private language that will express with absolute precision, that will recognize its singularity and the exclusive relationship of the one who suffers to her suffering. End of quote. In spite of their insistence on the sufferer's fundamental solitude, both Levinas and Ophir imply that the sufferer's intimacy is still to some degree shareable. Not least because we too, in our existential dimensions, are time indefinitely endured, in that the poet's language enables his readers to become waiters, sharers of the empty intimacy of time, observers of small flowers, sitters with the dead. Not that we could substitute such experiences with the reading of poems, but that such experiences might, through the reading of poems, become more fully possible. And the four poems that I'm going to read are in the service of providing this empathic understanding. 3, the no longer grasping. Your next quotation will be the poem by Rilke, but it will take me a while to get there. Rilke's poem, The Swan, belongs to his New Poems, published in 1907, about which volume he writes in a letter. I undertook to make use of lyric poetry in order to form not feelings, but things I had felt. For it is not question of the poet's feelings, such as one might attribute to one who has no patience to wait. It is question rather of the poetic form, such as a thing, a swan, for example, might require in order to be rendered justly, that is, beautifully. The swan uses an extended simile, a conceit, in which the swan's descent into the water is likened to our dying. The poem thus asks about dying. What face dying has, what it is to be going through dying, what dying wants to say. For poems, as we recall, are not, as people think, simply emotions. They are experiences. The swan exemplifies all the qualities of the poet who has seen many cities, many people and things, who has been beside the dying, and whose observations of a panther, a gazelle, a girl going blind, the washing of a corpse, a swan, all contribute to the singular, patient empathy of Rilke's gaze. The swan. This laboring through what is still undone, as though legs bound, we hobbled all along the way, is like the awkward walking of the swan. And dying, to let go, no longer feel the solid ground we stand on every day, is like anxious letting himself fall into the water, which receives him gently, and which, as though with reverence and joy, draws back past him in streams on either side, while infinitely silent and aware, in his full majesty and ever more indifferent, he condescends to glide. Although the poem employs the swan's awkward gait and falling into the water as a conceit for living and dying respectively, the swan's movements are not solely appropriated for rhetorical use. They are meticulously observed so that we see first the swan, and only then the metaphoric extension. On that metaphoric level, life, our life, is a laboring, musal, a grind, a drudgery, that which is yet to be done, and likewise the undone is ever before the living. We approach the undone, our own undoing, that is, as though legs bound. Our living resembles the awkward walking of the swan, while dying is likened to the swan's fearful falling, sich niederlassen, into the waters, which, as though with reverence and joy, draw back. Dying is a no longer grasping of the ground upon which we daily stand, and nicht mehr fassen jenes Grunds, auf dem wir täglich stehen, which signifies in two ways, in reference to the swan's descent into the water, in that we, who are dying, having taken the place of the swan, no longer feel the ground, and mentally, in that dying is the metaphoric extension of this physical image, a no longer grasping, an uncomprehending, which leads to the stanza break, to the silence between the second and third stanzas through which the swan's body descends to be received into the waters. There, the swan, in Edward Snow's more recent and more literal translation, is, quote, infinitely still and sure, with ever greater confidence and kingship, and self-possession to glide. Stephen Mitchell's translation approximates the hushed rhyme between Rilke's flut um flut, flood after flood, and the final rhyming word gerut, which means peace, quiet, pleasing, letting be, and which might imply a sublime harmony in acquiescence to death. While death is thoroughly idealized, in the swan's serene gliding, for us to get there requires a traumatic transition, a suffering and a dying in an incomprehensible temporal passage which is rendered in the silence between stanza 2 and 3. Seeking to convey some of Rilke's music, Mitchell accomplishes beautifully with slant rhymes, closely to render Rilke's rhyme, but some of his word choices conceal that living is in the first two stanzas alluded to as a falling short, a failure, an insufficiency, which I think the poem performs in its preempting the completion of the sonnet form. Assuming that the final sestet is complete in the serene, idealized sublimation of death, the poem also performs in the first two stanza this laboring through what is still undone in its forestalling of the opening octave in a usual Petrarchan sonnet, which is fragmented into two tercets, three lines each. The undone is reiterated in the third line in the swan's makeshift gate, literally unworked or unfinished, and subsequently in dieses nicht mehr fassen, this no longer grasping, all of which implies that dying is a rupture, a breaking off, an undoing, and no longer grasping. The poem itself labors through what is noch yet to be done, but that laboring will undo the sonnet. Indeed, the second stanza in the German original seems to me entirely stammered, the syntax undone, the sentence incomplete, the sense unaccomplished. Dying is an undoing. It undoes sentence and sonnet. And more precisely, living is not a laboring towards, and I mean here our living, because the poem is an allegory of our living and our dying. Our living is not a laboring towards what has not yet been done, towards what will undo us. It is a laboring through. It is living that undoes us. Our very gait betrays us. As though shackled, bound, fated, we always walk through what is undone. Our walking does it. Our affinity with the dying is in our gait. Levinas finds it in the face. Blanchot in the Grundstimmung of dread, the grounding sense of dread. Rilke in our blood, gaze, and gesture. Our ground can give way at any time. My gait, my gaze, my gesture, my face, my dread are as irreducibly singular to me as is my undoing. None can be made public. They constitute the idiosyncratic, intimate ways I labor through what I undo and what is always yet undone. At the end of our ever unaccomplished, unfinished walking is dying, das Sterben. The veritably traumatic process of dying is rendered as a loss precisely of that certainty, of the ground, which is also the word for reason, that once made living possible. Never having had that ground give way, the dying will do something that is yet undone. They will fearfully lower themselves down, and then the stanza is undone. The plank in reason breaks, the ground gives way, the stanza breaks. Dying is a no longer grasping, an incomprehension that is now in the final sestet carried through the image of the swan's beatific consents to be ferried through the tranquil water of death. Living and dying are foreshortened, fragmented, labored, but not so death. if the completed non-fragmentary final sested exemplifies Rilke's idealization of impersonal death, if in Blanchot's words it, quote, becomes the purity of death purified of dying, we must look for the intimacy that suffering is, or what Levinas calls the interiority of suffering, where it seems most hermetic, least shareable, and thus where the greatest effort is demanding of us, where the consolations of poetic closure are not yet available in the no longer grasping which is embodied in the sonnet's fragmentation, in his fearful descent, in the awkward pause, the Dickensian dash in the German original that retards the enjambment from the second to the third stanza, then in the silence, the pause, the very quiet aporia of the blank between the stanzas, wherein we are cast into our own solitude and silence. Despite being a living creature, the swan in this poem exemplifies Rilke's newfound programmatic fascination with things in the new poems. The thing, he writes in a letter in 1903, possesses, quote, a concentrated reality, and its duration is without retrospect or fear, which may have led Mitchell to attribute indifference to the swan's serene gliding in this stanza. But such idealizations of death, beautifully enacted in the swan's joyful reception into its native element, is perhaps merely a substitution of one allegorical afterlife for another, perhaps merely consolatory for a post-religious age. Thus, let us not abandon the scene of laboring and dying to reach the sublimity of death too quickly. Let us not pass across the space of the blank too hastily. Attention waits, we recall Blanchot. It waits without precipitation, leaving empty what is empty and keeping our haste, our impatient desire, from prematurely filling it. O Levinas, it is this attention to the suffering of the other that can be affirmed as the very nexus of human subjectivity. That's where we become who we are. Or Simone Weil, the capacity to give one's attention to a sufferer is a very rare and difficult thing. It is almost a miracle. It is a miracle. End of quote. It is in the poem's most reticent moments where another suffering can be heard. If these may be the equivalent of the unwilled intimate sounds of suffering, of gasping, of weeping that await their impossible transformations into words, then we understand why we are impatient and precipitous, why there are so few miracles. The silence of the stanza break. And I'll get to a new poem. The silence of the stanza break. Wordsworth's short poem, A Slumber Did My Spirit Seal, is generally grouped with the Lucy poems, even though the poem does not name the she who is its subject. Unnamed, she is a literal iteration of Rilke's stipulation that the poet write of experiences that return nameless. Brief and in sparsest language, Wordsworth's poem seems to tell of a young girl whose life passed in bliss, but is abruptly cut short by her sudden death. The most puzzling aspect of the poem is, as in Rilke's poem, here it is greatly amplified, the silence of the blank space between the two stanzas, the interiority of that silence wherein the nameless girl made her traumatic passage from life to death. A slumber did my spirit seal, I had no human fears. She seemed a thing that could not feel the touch of earthly years. No motion has she now, no force. She neither hears nor sees. Rolled round in earth's diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. While this poem seems to be about and has most frequently been read about as being about the sublimation of the poet's grief, It is in my reading altogether about suffering, albeit suffering erased in the poem's language, but perhaps kept in its silence. If the poem is only on the surface about the poet's grief, if it is more about the girl's death, then we might ask, what was she going through? How can we restore the nameless girl to this poem? She is remembered as a thing that could not feel the touch of earthly years, as if she was once happily in accord with the thing she would become among rocks and stones and trees. And yet, in the speaker's remembrance, she seemed a thing. Precisely this seeming betrays her humanity, perhaps his as well, which is her mortality. For the implication is, of course, that she was not a thing that could not feel, but the poet's feeling this may be too painful. Thus, the girl's reification into a thing made possible through the speaker's suppression of his human fears, his fears of her or his humanity, safeguard his own emotions. The second stanza, as Jeffrey Hartman explains, conveys, quote, a hint of indifference to which the girl's difference is reduced, and which, however tragic it may be, obeys a law that supports the stability a survivor's speech requires, end of quote. When the first stanza closes, and the stanza break opens to contain all the first stanza repressed yet implies, we realize that despite not seeming to feel, the girl must have very much felt the touch of earthly years, indeed so traumatically that her suffering and dying entirely fills the silence of the vast change from life to death that has occurred. The poem is permeated by that silence, in which she must have fearfully descended, anxiously let herself fall, having lost the ground upon which she daily stood. The silence between the stanzas, as in Wilke's poem, contains the no more grasping that renders as artless astonishment, moving in its utter simplicity, as if we overheard a child saying, no motion has she now, no force, she neither hears nor sees. But then, in the next two lines, this intimate, poignant, childish, and genuine confession is sublimated in an insentient, consolatory cosmology. To insist that this is a poem about suffering is, as in Rilke's The Swan, to refuse, at least so long as we wait in the stanza break, the consolations of what critics have called, quote, Wordsworth's blessing of impotentiality, unquote, or his affirmation of human, quote, invulnerability, unquote. Rather, what the inhuman time, as Mary Jacobus has put it, of the second stanza enables is a retrospective, meditative, perhaps even a somewhat impertinent return to the silence between the stanzas. We cannot let her go quite so quickly. Among the poet's requirements, Rilke notes that man muss zurückdenken können, you must be able to think back to streets in unknown neighborhoods, to childhood illnesses, to days in quiet, restrained rooms, such as we perform when we think back on the small radius of the poem's two very quiet, restrained stanzas, but also on the vast parameter of its narrative. The silence between the stanzas, and in which we might nonetheless hear the suffering of the nameless girl, has a duration. Quote, the ancientness of the earth and the still sad music of humanity come together in the word duration, Jacobus explains, which means not only lasting, but hardening, Latin durare, to endure, to last, and indurare, to harden, from durus, hard. mindful of the poignant implications of duration's etymology, let us wait within and listen more closely to such silent duration of suffering, which Ophir describes as exclusive, intolerable, untranslatable, and unceasing, all of which applies to the silence between the two stanzas. When Rilke lists the poet's prerequisites in the scene with the dying and the dead, you must also have been beside the dying, must have sat beside the dead in the room with the open window and the panting noises. His insistence to speak both of the dying and of the dead implies the time it takes to die, duration, lasting, hardening. The poet is to wait, first beside the dying, then to sit down beside the dead in a particular place, at a particular time, in the room with the open window and the noises. In history, not in a text. In Mitchell's translation, the noises are rendered as scattered. That's why you have panting in brackets. Which word relegates them outside the open window, scattered, implying the comforting distractions of public life going on outside, the distractions of the world, to recall Blanchot, that exists in our place and disburdens us of ourselves. But Rilke's adjective for the noises is unsettlingly stoßweise Geräusche, very strange, which is, I think, associated with the labored breathing of the dying, the thrusting, panting, gasping noises whose dissonance I had not noticed for about 3 decades. I had not wanted to know that stoßweise Geräusche is not scattered noises, because I did not want to hear the dissonance of the sufferer's labored breathing. I wanted to be outside the open window. I did not want to listen. The time that passes in Wordsworth's stanza break has the temporality of suffering. In reading this stanza break, we wait in the empty intimacy of time. As Blanchot reminds us, this intimacy can only be discreetly, Levinas recalls. It passes in our waiting, in its silences, in our acknowledgement of the indecipherable, dissonant signifying of suffering. Our waiting in this stanza break is informed by and informs all the waiting we have done and all the waiting we have yet to do. Thank you for your patience, really. Thank you. The temporality of a stone. Both the veil over the face of the woman and the hand over the face of the mother are gestures of anonymous suffering. That, as Levinas describes it, isolates itself in consciousness or absorbs the rest of consciousness. The mute stone and the mother's silence are composed by a suffering illegible as insentient blind matter. When the mother nevertheless speaks in the 5th stanza, asking, "Did you know some people say that pearls are tears?" the cliché conceals her suffering as much as her silence. The pearl is the final signified that will not be found. Alice Oswald's autobiography of a stone allegorizes these characteristics of suffering in the most introverted of symbols, a stone. The stone shelters within its mineral weight and mass, the hermetic quality of suffering, its empty intimacy of time. The stone is the material equivalent of the immaterial silence of suffering. The poem tells of the stone's falling into affliction. Autobiography of a stone. On this airborne earth, where the one thrust of things is endlessly upward, I, stone, fell into affliction worse than the annealing of glass, through the whole series of endurable pains and worse. And that was when I, stone, became this final measure of drawing my whole body inward into my skull. I became excluded stone, stone in hiding, who lies not peering out in a fold of the winds, and hearing myself being shouted for. Oh, if the wind were a voice I could contend with. But I am moving only very slowly, blasting out earth and keeping my gift under darkness. Among the experiences Rilke lists that make a poet most belong to Oswald's airborne earth, where the one thrust of things is endlessly upwards. In Rilke, they are most notably the flight of birds or the gestures that small flowers make when they open in the morning. Even the dying and the dead are attended to in rooms with open windows. Here, the very stone that cannot feel its fall, quote, the stone that cannot feel its falling, unquote, as Henry Bergson writes to exemplify the insentience of matter, falls into affliction. If so, there is no shelter from, no consolation for suffering. In Oswald's desolate projection, suffering affects even the inorganic world. It permeates Rilke's things, Wordsworth's rocks and stones and trees, and Boland's marble statue. The final measure of suffering is its introverted, unshareable, wholly withdrawn as a body drawn inward into my skull, all-encompassing duration. Quote, the entire duration of suffering folds into the present moment of suffering, as Ophir writes. Every moment of the present carries with it the entire duration of suffering. End of quote. The stone is the epitome of time without event. Let it be over, but it is without end. It is a searing pain, worse than the annealing of glass, and worse, seeking impossible comparisons on a geologic scale. The outer world has vanished, and the stone's answer to being shouted for is, after a pause, the almost inaudible oh that keeps the gift of suffering under darkness, of suffering that is always given like the special mark for affliction. Although the stone is the hypervisible, the material emblem of invisible suffering, we cannot see a stone. There are too many. They are too indistinct. Each is a unit in a collection, or a specimen from the social category labeled unfortunate. Like a common stone, suffering is invisible. These paradoxes multiply. The stone is the visible sign of the sufferer's silence, but it is also the mute sign of the sufferer's cry of anguish. Oswald's afflicted stone contains what falls in Rilke's poem, what rolls in Wordsworth's, what weeps in Boland's. In Giving Speech to a Stone, Autobiography of a Stone gives voice, paradoxically, to the anonymity of and solitude of the sufferer. Affliction is anonymous before all things, Simone Weil writes. And I quote the last quote, I think, that you have. It deprives its victims of their personality and makes them into things. It is indifferent. And it is the coldness of this indifference, a metallic coldness, that freezes all those it touches to the depths of their souls. They will never find warmth again. They will never believe anymore that they are anyone. End of quote. Oswald's excluded stone epitomizes the thing's metallic coldness. It represents that aspect of suffering by which a sufferer finds herself anonymous, excluded from the world, fallen when everything rises. The geologic temporality of a stone is the metaphor for the duration of suffering. The temporality of suffering is that of a stone. It seems a thing that cannot feel the touch of earthly years. The stone's nondescript mass, weight, and circumference both reveal and conceal the sufferer's hermetic circular temporality. The materiality of the stone moves suffering from from its subjective, unascertainable, merely affective, therefore dubious qualities into the certainty of matter, even as that certainty is mutely sealed in that same materiality. Last paragraph. The temporality of suffering is, in Ophir's words, untranslatable and unbridgeable. The temporality of remembering is, quote, difficult and terrible. These words seem wholly applicable to Oswald Stone. It is untranslatable and unbridgeable. The poem's formidable task as a poem is to overcome the temporality of suffering by rendering it as difficult and terrible as it is. The moment when this labor seems to me most believable is when the narrative past tense in the third stanza moves into fragmented syntax and into the present tense, where, hidden in a fold of the winds, the stone cannot contend with the wind's noise. The almost inaudible O barely reaches us across that small but perhaps deep silence within which I imagine the stone moves at a stone's speed, only very slowly, like the swan mussel's foot, like the labored breathing of the dying. Thank you so much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Bucknell University Professor of English, Harold Schweitzer. Professor Schweitzer's lecture was titled The Poetry of Suffering and Waiting and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director Alan Spate. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.